my love to everyone. And that's an honest love. It comes from that one place. Nobody has to be worried about that. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be with us. A life spent for 29 years in the way of the Sufi, little by little, winning and sometimes losing a little, but always focused on that which is going to be the complete reward. That's my story. And in it, there are some really astonishing highlights. The things that one could not anticipate when one starts to find out about something that they don't know anything about. In 1972, a friend told me about Baba Mahiyadeen. And so one night, they said, he'll fill you up. They noticed that I was not being very happy. They said, you come on those nights when Baba speaks and he'll fill you up. So I came to West Philadelphia, where I hadn't frequented for many, many years. Noticed everybody had taken off their shoes, took off my shoes, and went into a house that was just a rented house. And I saw that the house was not much, but the feeling of goodness was already very powerful. And I said, well, this place is not so beautiful, but I feel good here. And he hadn't even appeared yet. He was upstairs. And when he came down the steps, I didn't have a framework for someone like that at all. I had not dabbled in all the things people had been dabbling in the 60s. I was raising 5 children. And I looked at him and I only saw, and in the sense someone asked me, what did you mean when you said see? I realized his heart, which was like the heart of E.T., it like opened out and these marvelous eyes, and that's all I saw. And then we all sat down to await the discourse. And I had been for years trying to find out where holy was. And suddenly everything burst loose and it said, he knows, he knows. And it was like this moment of great joy of what I had been looking for, knowing not what it was. And so began the 29 years. In the immediate beginning, there was a very, very powerful whatever that is. And at the end of that evening, Baba came over to me and he put his hands on my head and he said, you mustn't be too fascinated by the magic of mind. And I said, oh, he knows I have a fine mind. And he did. And he got rid of it immediately. And what happened then was, I couldn't memorize anything. I could not be trusted to say what he said, because everything entered on another stream of consciousness. And it's still coming forward. There are many times when I think, oh, I have realized this. And then I was responsible for indexing at the fellowship, and I would index an early discourse and find that he had said that. And I did not have it memorized. It was not in my this memory. It was in that stream that was supposed to lead to the ultimate wisdom. And so it has been that my trust was almost immediately placed in that which could not be seen, felt, and so forth. It really was all going to be inner knower or nothing. In a very short time, maybe because of this, I don't know, but within I had come to him on the night of the 9th of January. It's very nearly, like an anniversary. And in the very first of March, an experience happened that people hope and pray for all their lives. But since I knew nothing, I didn't know that that was so. I had been listening to the discourses and actually slept over in that house on Friday night. And all day Saturday, went home to wash and came back again on Sunday. And then on Monday morning, I was watching him on the bed where he sat discoursing. And it was like the camera had blurred and everything faded away, and the only thing that came forward was power. And it was an enveloping power that was unmistakable power. I had no reference for it. I had no understanding. Only later did I find that they had a word for it called fana. It took about 2 days to come back to some kind of normalcy because it was like splat. And then there was all the rest of the years to find out other things. But what that did was establish for once and forever the unseen power that is enveloping us all the time, that we are distracted from, or we haven't faded everything else away from so that we could know it. But it's always there. It's the omnipresent. And that's experienced faith. If you have an experience like that and you forget it, you'd have to be perfectly mad. And so from then on, I began to really understand more of what everyday work would be. This was a bonus of the highest order. And everyday work was trying to grasp what to handle first. It was like 4, 5, 6 pickup sticks. I said, well, this is easy. I'll work on that and I'll get that away. And then I would get to the ones that were a little knottier, and if it was a little bit too tough, I didn't do anything. I just worked on what I could work on. And that was the kind of thing that also got mixed with an interesting attempt to move in under words, move in to find out the subtleties, to try and say, well, what did that really mean? You have a nomenclature that comes from a foreign country. Bawa was speaking in Tamil. And there was a translator who was speaking in British colonial English. And let me tell you, the only people who can understand British colonial English are the people from the other colonies who have been spoken to in that way. It was not English as we speak it in America. So I decided to go to college and learn the Tamil language because it was too hard to get the transliteration down. That was coming out in two different forms. And so in 1973, I did go to the University of Pennsylvania and had another mystical experience. There's 264 letters in that alphabet because they join all of the vowels to the consonants. And the teacher said that he was going to make us write what he was saying in 3 days. And that was another experience of everything left my body. It was like I was not on my time. But I learned enough to be able to experience things more directly. Not perfect, but more directly. The next thing that happened that was very special was that Bawa was going to have to return to Sri Lanka within 5 months of my having met him. And I really couldn't bear that. I just couldn't bear it. I was in a molten stage. It was, something was happening that it shouldn't stop, you know? So I went with the people that were going to renew their visas along with his. I managed through my father to find a person who would extend the visas for another couple months. Then it was time again for them to leave. And I thought, maybe I could go. Maybe I could go. So I asked his permission. And he said, don't you see this happy heart? And so I proceeded and ended up in a fairy tale, a total fairy tale. And believe me, I have a space for that. But this one went beyond all the things that I'd known as a child. And we were met at the airport with beautiful sounds of drums and horns and people, and it was just a great glory. And it went on. By the time we had taken the airplane, we spent some time in Colombo, but his ashram was in Jaffna, and we took the airplane to Jaffna, and that was another whole happening. An entire police force turned out, and every house that we stopped at, they decorated us with garlands and garlands and garlands. And then we finally reached the ashram. And it was so thick with people, you couldn't see the daylight. And it was something outsized. And I just tried to understand this little person that I am in this setting and proceeded from there. I wanted so much to understand what it was like for him in that native country. And he was really interesting. He knew that that's what I wanted. And he proceeded to ask me to go and take tea every time I sat down with him. Did you have tea? Which meant that I was really dismissed. And I said, first I said no, and then I went and I had tea. And then after a while I said, well, I did have tea, but I'll go and have tea again. And it was a learning experience. He was taking this very independent lady that I am, basically, and a person who was pretty much in charge, and he absolutely made me not in charge of anything, not even my right to come and listen to what was going to go on between him and his earlier followers. So eventually everything worked out, but there was this exquisite moment one morning when he, with his shawl not furled in a turban, but just loose, came down the hallway to the suite of rooms that I had been given. And I was being given a breakfast there at the end of the hallway in a little beautiful room. And he sat down to have breakfast with me, not because he ate, he didn't eat. But it was like an exalted happening. I don't know how to say what that was like. He had a translator with him and we chatted. It was like ordinary, everyday chatting. I don't know what he was raising me into, but it was certainly a raising of some kind. And then he asked my permission to leave, and I gave him that permission, and he went back to the space that he was occupying in speaking to those that came to him. In the morning, judges and people of state would arrive around 6 or 6:30 in the morning to receive his wisdom for the day. I thought that was so exemplary. I wonder if in America, a judge would go to some wise man and get some really good feeling for the day. But that's what would be happening. And there was, of course, the loveliness of the beauty of the women in the saris who were part of the family and part of the people that had come to be learning, and it was a learning all the time. No matter what it was a learning. Finally, it came time, I spent a month there for me to leave. And it was such a grievous thing again to have to leave. that I lay on my bed that night and I said, isn't it funny? I don't have an emotion about it, but I know that I feel something. And there was this tremendous tightening around my rib cage and my torso, and I fell asleep. And the next morning, Bawa said to me, your subtle body came to me in the night, and it spoke Tamil. He said, now you can come to me anytime you want to, from wherever you are, because of the use of the subtle body. Well, believe me, I didn't know a thing about it. You talk about egoless. There's nothing of, I don't know how that happened, but he said it happened, and I believed him. I always believed him, because in the first couple of weeks, I disputed with what he would say. He would say, it's very easy for you, and inside my little naysayer would say, oh no, it's easy for him, it's not easy for you. And after a couple of weeks, I said to myself, yeah, you keep doing that and you really won't get anything. You're finished. So I stopped doing that. So when he said that I could, I thought I could, but I didn't know how. I came back to America. And I came back to difficulties in the home that we had rented for our children at the seashore. And they were so bad, and the damages were so bad and everything. It was like, you know, riding on this marvelous thing that was really not my own. And I was plummeting. And I went to the window, and I looked out, and I said, oh, God, I am not, and you are, and I hope you like it. It was so terrible. And then I lay on the bed, and I remembered how I had felt in that time and wanted so much to be at the fellowship in Philadelphia that I sent myself there. But the good luck was that the next morning, a letter was being looked for from Sri Lanka. And I called, and the young man who had been one of the major translators said to me, Sonia, were you here last night? And I said, why are you saying that? And he said, because everybody said that they felt your presence here. And I thought, gee, Bawa was right. I can do it. And there is a way in which the subtle body does do for me to gather information, not all the time, but when I'm desperate to. A young woman who was supposed to be coming to the fellowship, who had cancer, ended up on a friend's boat, houseboat, and I couldn't get in touch with her. She didn't have a telephone. And something caused me to want very much to get in touch with her. And I did that same thing. And the information that I got was that she had no money. And without any further ado, I put a $20 bill into an envelope to the post office box that she had. And she said, you know, Sonia, when that came, I had $1 left to my name. So I trust those things. I don't know more than to tell you what has happened. There is the space that has to do with the polishing of the qualities of a human being that is so essential. One time I owned a mineral and jewelry magazine. And one of the nights that I was out in Tucson, we were going to dinner with people who sold faceting machines. And they said, we're not taking you to dinner until you see how a faceting machine works. And so they made me work this faceting. Fortunately, the machine really is very knowledgeable. It does everything by itself. But the story about a gem is that it is not a gem until it has been polished and faceted or cabbed. And the most important thing for me was that the light comes in from the top. Lots of times we look at gems and we think that the light is coming from the bottom. But the light comes in from the top with every facet mirroring that light. But the facets have to be perfect. You get one facet that goes wrong and the light is diminished in the stone. This is an extremely important knowledge for us. Because, in fact, our impediments are like that. You can be like 50-50, 50% perfectly faceted, and the rest of it not so good. The light really doesn't come out. And there was another time relating to that kind of understanding, which was a spur for my work, was speaking to the chief engineer at our radio station, and he said, you know, Sonia, he said, the power is not sent far because there is a powerful transmitter. He said, it's the height of the transmitter that sends this signal. And I thought, yes, it has to do with the levels of wisdom that grow higher and higher and send these signals. I called him recently to make sure that that is what we had said to each other all those years ago, and he said, oh, he said, that's wonderful, you remember that. That part of my memory does work. But everything that we do that is a refinement of a good quality is the way in which the light gets sent on. It gets sent on to the next good quality and the next good quality. And it only breaks down when it bumps into a quality that is not good. And then we have to start again, and we have to understand somehow through introspect what is happening. And what I said yesterday is that I spend most of my life in ponder and wonder. It lies between pondering and wondering, and it really is a life that gets most of its goodness and information from periods of just plain quietness, not imposed, not anything very glamorous. I mean, I don't look like I'm doing that at all. I can be, as I said, in a line in a supermarket, and that will happen. Or I can be remembering God in a zikr that's very profound anywhere. Because I really took very seriously what Bawa said, that the entire world is your prayer mat, and you can pray anywhere on it. Special places are good as focal points if somebody doesn't know that. Special places are special. But the world is there, the sky is there. We are firm in our conviction, and all we have to do is face it. And it's quite marvelous. So there were those things that had to do with me personally. And then there was the aspect of being a mother. And somebody said, well, what did you do about all your children? Well, I took them with me to the fellowship. And each according to his personality. One fell asleep under the tea table. One was seated up on the steps. The youngest one, Mignon, was in front of me. And, I think Leaf was walking around the kitchen. It was not easy, but it was doable. And the good thing about it is that to whatever extent a child wanted to take in the wisdom that Bawa was giving, they could. There was no, stay in that seat and be still. It wasn't like that at all. And so one day when Leif, the fourth child, the one who actually has been a very, very big helper to me in this life, came to me from school and he pushed his books down on the table and he said, I have to see Bawa. He said, he has to help me with this teacher. So I was both surprised and delighted. And we went to Bawa that evening, and he told him the problems that he was having with a teacher who was really about ready for retirement, and who had actually inflamed a lot of parents. And I thought, well, Bawa will tell him the proper thing to do. And Bawa heard his story, and he looked at me and he said, the teacher is wrong. And at that point, I said, oh, fine. The teacher is wrong. What now? He said to Dr. Ajwan, he said, get a piece of paper. I'm going to write a letter to the teacher, but it's going to be a letter from Leaf. And he numbered it the way the sentences are numbered in the Quran. It was very interesting. There was about 12 of those sentences. And I'm just going to lightly paraphrase because I don't really remember all the sentences, but he said, please, teacher, please remember that you are a mother to my wisdom, and I can only learn from you in a state where I have no fear. Please teach me with love and kindness and not with anything that frightens me. And it went on much more beautifully, and he signed it, in Jesus' name, Leaf. I thought, how did he know that this teacher was a Christian? Well, he just knew. And I thought, this amazing letter is coming from Leaf. So I wrote a little note to the teacher that this man is our teacher of wisdom, and that he wrote this from Leaf Owen's heart. And that was the explanation. And she took a look at that letter, and she was transformed. She showed it to every teacher that she could and took it down to the principal. And Leaf's life with her from then on was marvelous. He was the only one invited to her swimming pool. But can you imagine a happening like that? And he knows that. And there is a vibration that this teacher has given through all of his songs that is so healing that this son, who now has fibromyalgia and had chronic fatigue syndrome, that was from making a great success out of a magazine that should not have been a success, he would wake up in the night and couldn't sleep from the pain. And as soon as he put on Bao's song, he was asleep in 10 minutes. Well, at that time, my daughter Beth and her children were living with me at the same time, and her children were also in the habit of playing a song of Bao as if there was any trouble. So at 4 o'clock in the morning, there is a song of Bao from the back of the house, and there's one in the middle of the house. And she said to me, what was troubling you? She said to me, she thought it was in my room. And I said, oh, nothing was troubling me. She said, but I heard you playing Bao's song last night. And she said, I thought that maybe, and it was her son. It was Max. He said, I was playing Bao's song. He said, I was troubled. So there was, it's not just one song. It's whatever of all the many songs that we have on the tapes was available that the person felt would be helpful. Now, another thing that has happened is that the third generation, well, there's me, then there's my children, and then there are the children of Beth. They have so clearly connected with that and the power that even the things that people say are being parroted are not being parroted. They come with a force all of their own. And I was saying yesterday about a time when Max was playing in the schoolyard, very, very tiny child, when the airplane that carried Heinz, that blew up, it blew up right over. I heard the bang. I couldn't believe that it was really something in our neighborhood. And in fact, it was right over his head. He saw the flames and began running with a Subhanallah Kalima on his tongue. He didn't think it. It fell out of him. It was the declaration of that power that was beyond all other powers, and he did escape. There were two little girls who unfortunately didn't. But it was an outrageous time. And the wonder was that inherent in the children is an ongoing running affirmation that will just express itself at any time. It's really quite wonderful. It turned out that Fatima was telling me that my daughter, who was the mother of Max, was having a difficulty with him early on. There had been a divorce. There was a difficulty in his life, and he was not speaking in class. He wouldn't speak out. He wouldn't tell any stories. He wouldn't do anything. And finally, after that incident, a teacher said to him, won't you say something? And he said, Subhanallahi walhamdulillahi. Recently, he's now 16, a teacher wanted to know what was important to him in his life. And he directed her to the fellowship house with the mosque behind it. He said, this is what's important in my life. Now, he's like an ordinary kid. I mean, he does his skateboarding, he does his lawn, he does everything. But astonishingly, that was what was important in his life. So without rigor and without rigidity in the real Sufi way, all of the happenings are happening. And we're not fastened into anything. It's bad enough that we've had all the attachments that we have had. And we're trying very hard to carefully look at those and rid ourselves of those whenever. It's a very interesting work. I remember the day that I walked up to the Fellowship House, which is a neo-Greek classic style architecture. And they had sawed off the bottom of three of the columns. I usually knew about what was going to happen to a house, but nobody told me. And they were throwing up a form of a block of rather rude cement under it. And I said, what happened? I mean, I was so wounded. Of course, I immediately knew where my attachment was. They said, well, they were rotting, and this is all that we could think of to do, which was really unfortunate. It was not the only thing to do, but that's what they did. And the awful thing was that one was still standing, the correct length of column with its beautiful finish on the bottom. And I said, well, Sonia, that's your problem, an aesthetic. You're attached to aesthetics. So you can find it anywhere if you're looking. You have to have your little glass ready all day long to find out. And if you didn't find out all day long, there is a marvelous thing that I do without question, always have done it, toward the end of the afternoon, which is to replay all the tapes of the day, to rehear them, to find out what really did happen, at least to that extent. And it's a lot of information. And it's a lot of information, especially if you're going the Sufi way, because things that don't match up. But a lot of things do match up, which is good. That really is my major practice. My major practice is what Fatima was telling me is fikr. It's an examination that goes beyond ordinary examination. It goes deeper and deeper. And the whole wonderful thing of this life is that we are afforded all of the hours that we have for examination. It's not like, I was never a taker for guilt. Guilt was not my style, and I really refused it. It's like not happening. But what is happening is sadness if something that I thought was more correct was not correct. That's different from guilt. Guilt goes nowhere. So these examinations are really very important. They're held very even-handedly. And hopefully the intelligence to become better is there. If not, then all is lost. I mean, really. We're not a group that is unintelligent. The major understandings of my life, really, are service and duty, but not the way it's imposed from without. And interestingly enough, you know, they talk about the five fards in or fards in Islam, and they use an English word that really came from the Latin, which is obligation. And I don't find Latin to be a good translating language for Arabic at all. I'm very, very sensitive to things relating to language. And I said to, we were, Manny Levin and Teddy Levin and I were reading the Quran every Friday. And I said, we were coming back from dinner, and we were going to sit down in the dining room and do what we do. We do it from three different translations so that we find out, well, where were they really in total agreement regarding the language? Because we don't read Arabic. I read a little, but not much. And it works out fine. Anyway, on the way home, I said, you know, I really refuse to use that word obligation. It doesn't feel right. He says, so look it up. He's a lawyer. So I, as a person who is obedient, went home, got the proper spelling out of one dictionary and went to the other, and sure enough, it doesn't mean obligation. It's a first incision or a notch. Without it, you can't begin the operation. That's different. That's from the inside of it. It's not something that somebody else obliges me to do. I must do this in order to go further. And that's the real definition. And if I find any other words that are bothering me like that, I'm going to do the same thing. It's not an obligation that somebody obliges you. It's something that is inherent in the progress within it. It's the first incision or the first notch. Well, the touching base with things Arabic and Islamic, after having killed myself to learn Tamil, was the next step. And I was relating something yesterday about how I became a Muslim. It was sliding into Sufi way, and then the next step that some took was to become a Muslim. And I had not really formally done that, and I didn't see any need to. And then we were invited to Mecca and Medina on Umrah. And my daughter asked, you know, she said we should call back and accept. And I said, I'm not going. And she said, what? I said, I'm not going. And she said, oh, mother, please. She said, this is going to be my only chance maybe in life, and I am going. She was definitely already had taken the shot, but I had not. And she said, wait a day. So I said, all right, I'll wait a day. And then there got to be a dialogue between me and my inner knower. And it was a lot of nice, quiet time spent as I was walking along. It said, you don't care about Mecca and Medina, do you? And I said, no. And the questioner said, but you do care about Jerusalem. I said, oh, yes. I said, why don't you care about Mecca and Medina? And that was the moment of truth. That was a terrible moment for me. If you are going to really be in the way of God, is there anything that you wouldn't care a lot about? Is there any people you wouldn't care a lot about? How would you really be a servant of any kind if there was any kind of favoritism at all? And I was so shocked. I said, I know what to do about this. I am going to be a Muslim. So I went home and I told Beth that we would be able to go. And I went to the mosque and I did everything that was appropriate, which is just declaring that you believe in the one formless God and that Muhammad is his messenger. It was certainly a lot easier than I had thought, I guess. And then I had the rewards, but not before I didn't really have a very, very powerful exchange regarding who this messenger is. Because I really did not know, and I could not imagine making a pilgrimage without knowing. I had no idea why I was going on Umrah. I reread the histories. That really was no help. And I read some of the hadith, and that wasn't good enough either. And I stood up beside my bed one night around 1 o'clock in the morning crying, and I said, oh God, you know your messenger, and I don't. And I'm supposed to be going on a pilgrimage. Regarding what? Please tell me about your messenger. And the story began to unfold from within me, making me the persona of that messenger, putting me through all of the things of his life, until finally I had come to the place which was the crucial thing, which was he really going to be able to last long enough to give that message to a people who were supposed to have had it for thousands of years and had refused it? And he managed, and then the history came out right. Then I saw him in that valley, hungry, and with his people around him not having enough water or anything, still filled with the message, filled with the call that he had to give it. And it was at last going to happen because he had something that none other had had for this people. And the prophecy that had been made regarding Ishmael was now going to be fulfilled. God's prophecies are always supposed to be fulfilled. Well, after that night, I really knew enough to go. And when I got there, there was this amazing, it's an astonishing thing that they have created there. And everything was about Abraham. And I said, what kind of a secret is this? The whole world doesn't know that this is all about Abraham. That it was to cleanse the cub, get rid of the idols, and make it the way it was when Abraham made his first little structure there, according to their story. And I prayed in the area that is just beyond, it's the station of Abraham. And it was definitely an exiting of some kind. It was wonderful. It was filled with all of that which is sacred. In the process of doing the Tawaf, I had not memorized any of the prayers except the most rudimentary. There was no big knowledge that I brought to Umrah. Umrah was going to create a knowledge in me. I was not going to bring knowledge there. And so this man, Suleiman, who was the leader, they have a name for the people who do that, and led us around in the Tawafs, held to me tightly, and I followed without thinking everything he said, and without really numbering the number of Tawafs. It seemed to me that I came to the space around the fifth time that my soul was revealed to me as an eternal soul whose portion was within me, that I could pray with in my temporary body, but that my soul existed in eternity. And a moment like that is worth lifetimes. It was worth lifetimes. And of course, everything else was fine. And I thought that really you couldn't get more than that. What else would you want to know? But 2 years later, a large group was going there with Manny Levin as leader. He said, I'm watching you, I'm watching you. He said, I'm not ready yet, but I'm watching you. And then finally he decided that, yes, he wanted to do that. And so there were about 65 people, and I thought, you know what, I better go along. Something may happen that I could be of help. Because I thought that my whole story was in. But my whole story really wasn't in. And so one night, around 3:30, you know, the nights there are like daytime here. Everybody is doing everything at night. It's the most, well, first of all, it's cultural. If you live in a desert area, the sun is not your friend, and the moon is. It was an interesting thing to understand.